heaven after this praise in the house.
Doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. To hear the whistle blow, she's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Good old pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board, and you're tuned to the Prairie Monk, as he already said. And this is WEFT's weekly look at the environment and rails and trails and prairies and lots of other wonderful things that we have in one amount or another throughout East Central Illinois.
Yes, today I want to say something about Kay Aston. Kay Aston just turned 100, which is quite something. And Kay has been head of English as a Second Language, retired from there. And she is holed up in the Inman Building, which is around the corner from WEFT. It's where people can retire and receive assisted living. So there was a celebration yesterday, and there was a mixture of people from academia and people who are caregivers. Kay grew up in Kansas. Her family had an English background, if I believe rightly, and had farmland in central Kansas, sort of on rolling hills. She got her undergraduate degree from Lawrence, Kansas, and University of Kansas, and went on to Bryn Mawr in Pennsylvania. Got her doctorate there, and in between some time, she was in Japan and sorted out her thesis, and eventually was invited to come to Illinois. Let me go back a little bit. She was part of an organization called The Teaching of English as a Second Language. After World War II, there was an influx of GI people who needed to do course upgrades in English, and they were in the same classes as people being invited from overseas who had had some English background to get here in the first place, but needed to be taught differently from the GI people. The GI people were older, they'd had an experience, and they were about to be taught properly in their terms, because they'd had that experience of driving tanks and organizing people, and they wanted to get on with it. The English as a second language people were often from other countries with ethnic differences, and so Mary Hussey and another lady, I forget her name, but they went together to suggest to the English department that or the Modern Languages Department, I don't know which, that there should be a special unit called the Teaching of English as a Second Language, and they did that. When they were retired, they invited Kay to be a member of the department, and she came from those somewhat rolling hills of Kansas to Illinois, and she thought it was so flat. She wondered how long she was going to stay here, but she stayed here for a long time. So she has supporters. One of them is Susan Taylor, whom we know well. And so there's a team of people that teach this the subject matter. And I happen to, my wife Jan and I lived in a building next door to Follett's on campus. It's very near the corner Wright Street and Green, about 100 yards from the present location of the alma mater. I'm not sure how Kay got to that set of apartments. It was a fraternity that had fallen out in the Depression era, and the Dallenbaugh family had bought it and used it for storage for a while. And then two women from Lebanon, Tennessee, came by, and they had a house restaurant in Havana over there, more towards Lincoln Avenue. And they thought that this would be a good place for a sophisticated restaurant. And so Mrs. Smith, who was the business person, and Daisy Daisy Baines. I'm thinking of a prairie bane called Flea Bane. So, glitch. But Daisy Baines was the mother of Mrs. Dallenbaugh. And so Mrs. Smith was the organizer, and Daisy was the associate. She painted, and she welcome people. She smoked with a long Tiffany-era cigar holder or cigarette holder, and it was rather popular with students and the like. And so these were two different people, but they were a team, and they did operate a Southern Tea Rooms in that fraternity building. It was very popular. It was very sophisticated. It was a Southern tea room, and you dressed appropriately with a tie and coat, and probably the women had to have gloves. It was where the Board of Trustees met when there was no union. And so they met for years there. Let's go back to the fraternity era. This was a large fraternity house. It was the highest building on campus. If you stood on the roof, you were looking down on Folds. A substantial building. It had a veranda that looked out over Green Street. It today is McDonald's, or it's been taken over for business, but for other types of business. But it was set back a little bit. There was a front lawn with a privet hedge around it and a walkway in. There was a driveway, and people would be absolutely amazed when you stopped in the middle of Green Street to drive into the driveway, and there was a lawn and garden where people would wait later for restaurants, but there had been a garage built there. And we still have the 1954 Lincoln that they used to drive and would go to a retreat in Wisconsin, was it? It was a very short-based Lincoln and very powerful, so its power-to-weight ratio meant that it was used a lot in races. So, but this is part of the history of Champaign, which is coming up now that Kay used to live there. Go back to the fraternity era. You had this setback house with a front door, a big glass door with an airlock, and then you walked into a foyer which was huge and tall, and there was this stairwell with wide stairs getting to narrow stairs that went upstairs, the administration building and rooms, and the live-in administrator was on the second floor, along with restrooms. And the restrooms were positively huge. Students would live dormitory style on the third floor mainly, but in other places too. But this was a tradition. You often left the windows open. In wintertime, if you happened to have a night's snow, you might just wake up with snow on your bed. The area could be cleared for a ballroom. And so the floor was hardwood floor that was good to dance on if you were doing the Charleston or something like that. The front foyer was Tiffany era style too. There's a grand piano, and George Foster, who later became a professor of art at this university, would play the violin, but other people would be guest musicians too. Would be a standard Tiffany era cat, perhaps even a bird cage with a bird. I didn't ever hear anything about a cockatoo, but sometimes you would have birds floating around that were part of the act. So when the union was built, the Board of Trustees had a boardroom meeting room there, and it was obvious that this was out of style anymore. So Mrs. Smith went round the floors lining up apartments in the fraternity era. The meal room or dining room was on the first floor, so that had to be remodeled. And there were 16 apartments in the whole building, and they were very individualistic. They would, if they had to go around a pillar or something, the wall went around the pillar. It didn't have to necessarily be rectilinear. So you could walk in and enjoy a meal there. If you were on July 4th, the parade used to go down Green Street. And so all the friends and relatives, and I assume in the student days, the same thing. You could sit on the porch, which was probably about 3 or 4 feet higher than the street, and you could watch the parade go by. The parade no longer goes by that way, but it used to. So many of the apartment dwellers belonged to the theater department or humanities, and somehow Kay got to be living there, and then Susan Taylor was living there too. And at that time, I had been living in Garber's, which was the dry cleaners just at the back, and I found out that there was a vacant apartment there. So we took an apartment in that lot and got to know Kay and Susan and all the others that were there. And this was really a little bit like home away from home, because we all knew each other. And some of us were local from places like St. Joe. And also there were these relationships to theater and things like that. So Kay was invited, and she was absolutely amazed. She'd grown up with gently rolling hills in Kansas, but this was flat. This was flat, 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 flat. Mm. And she didn't know whether she was going to stay a year or not, but she stayed for a long time. And once again, there was all these associations that it was people. And on Saturday, there was a celebration of her 100th birthday. And so there were academicians who had shared life with Kay. And there were also caretakers. So I was talking to people. Kay is a little bit hard of the hearing at the moment, so people had to be very close to her to speak. So I was talking to people that were local. So Anne is a major helper and put this together along with other helpers. And her husband was sitting by his horse. I joined him, and they come from Sidoras. So that put me into a spin of talking about Sidoras. Sidoras is a fun little town. I'll digress for a moment. It's southwest of Champaign by about 14 miles. And it's where Grandpappy Sidoras came with his covered wagon and got bogged in the Grand Prairie of East Central Illinois. And so he settled there, and that became Sidoras. And I used to go there because it's on the Wabash Railroad, and the railroads are the only place where we find prairie. So I have walked that area. If you go west a little bit, you get to Ivesdale, which was kind of Irish. And if you wanted a beer in Prohibition time, you went to a bar in Ivesdale, because it's legally or illegally allowed that sort of activity. And it was well known for that. So Sidoras has now a little park which relates to the Trail of Tears and the passageway of people through from the east to Oklahoma. And there's to the south, the Kaskaskia River goes by and leaves wetlands and areas of forest that have become there's a Sidoras Sportsman's Club. And somehow ran into a farmer who was preserving farm equipment, but he had also saved the Sidoras jail. Well, the Sidoras jail, the historic jail, was about 10 by 10 square with flat 10-inch by 10-inch lumber nailed together. And there was just enough room for about two drunk citizens. I hope it's still alive, but it was on the first farmland, and if you go off 57 into Sidoras. But Sidoras is one of these little towns that has antique dealers and people who can afford to be just a little way out of town. There's often a triumvirate of churches that find their way there. And there's an elevator, and the elevator produces lots of dust. So from time to time, I get calls from Sidoras to complain about the dust. The Anne's husband, whom I was talking to, lives about a mile south and near to the Sportsman's Club, I imagine. But there's all sorts of little history here that relates.
So can you expand a little bit why, if there's dust from an elevator in Sidoras, do people call you? Is it your fault?
I think they know that I'm an environmentalist, and they don't know quite who to call. And so I get there by default. And there's a lot of situations like that. People don't know how to recycle things sometimes. And the same sort of thing happens. Well, the next person I talked to was from Bonneville, Jim Fay. And I've known him for a long time. He would take Kay to see her sister in Ohio. And there were several of them there. There was one gentleman from Ohio who knew Kay in Ohio. And it's not too far from Banner, Ohio, where we have to know that our citizens came across the country, and people from Banner, Ohio came to Illinois and named Banner, Illinois, and Champaign County is in there, that name too. So he came for the celebration, and so we were chatting away, and we somehow got onto railroads because we're thinking to rerail, or we're in the process of rerailing between Whiteheath and Seymour with the hope of getting historic trains into Champaign from the Railroad Museum at Monticello. And so we got talking about trikes, and we wondered if there could be a line somewhere where people could work an original trike. Trikes used to have two people pumpers and four people pumpers. And if you were taking this workman's vehicle, usually trailing a trail with sleepers or ties or rails, and so it was hard work. But once you got up speed, you could do 30 miles an hour. A four-man pumper could move. These days they have motorized cars to do the same thing. And at that time, young folk would get together, and one of the things they would do is take a bicycle and have an outrigger wheel on one side of the line and have the bicycle on the other side. So you could move on a railroad bed that wasn't being used very much. The problem was that you were all upside, had all the weight on one side, and it could very easily tip all over. Better was to have a 1955-56 Chevy, because it has about the exact same width as the rails. So you let the tire down, and you get a six-pack, and you travel along a vacant rail bed that's not being used very much, and you hope that you don't run into a train.
That can't mean drinking and driving. What's a six-pack?
A six-pack is a six-pack of beer.
You actually meant you drive on the train tracks with your car.
With your beer.
Alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. How else would you have fun in the 1950s or
okay,
whatever?
All right.
So we talked about these sorts of things, and I talked to academic people who have had Kay and Susan and others as their teachers, and there were church people there because Kay has a Catholic background, and she's been an organizer in church activities and attends church regularly. And they were taking Kay at 5 o'clock to Mass. So these are the little things that make people friends and understand each other. And WEF does some of this, but it's hard to do. It takes time, and you need to know their backgrounds, and they need to know your background. So you have to be generous enough to give some of your information in order for them to allow to be able to share their information. A certain sort of credibility has to derive between people when they're talking to each other. And we don't always have a lot of time to talk. We can get a lot of information from the internet. So that means you don't exactly have to talk to each other to extract information about a pumper, a railroad maintenance vehicle. You can and go to the internet, and you get a picture, and you get all your information right there. Whereas by just talking to each other, you're going to take time. Well, back to Kay's situation. I think it was very appropriate that she have a group of people together that knew each other and cared, and so we hope Kay will have many more years to come. It's getting interesting. There's a lot of people that are over 100 these days, mainly because of health improvement and because people realizing their own capacity to look at their bodies. One academic person I was talking to was saying that she's morphed into yoga. And yoga is exercise in one way, but it's also exercise of your brain. It can be a very psychological thing, and there's a lot of different yogas, but they all have the element of bringing your body and soul together. And we hope that some of these programs that we have at WEFT do the same sort of thing. You have music people and people with a background that come from a different state or a different place and have a different attitude. You have, on Monday nights, you have local people come in to play music, and that eventually goes onto YouTube. We have a problem some because people who are listening to folk music may not necessarily be people who have a sophistication in being able to listen to some of our programs on internet, on YouTube, or on streamed on computers. Like, I was looking at some of UPTV's offerings, and there they have grade school children introducing themselves on radio and talking about things. And I'm wondering how grandma can get access to this on the computer. So do we have to assume that all people have sophisticated computer capacity? So David and I have been talking about WEFT for that reason, because when it says go live or listen to WEFT live, you don't necessarily get WEFT live. You have to know a little bit to whether you're going to go to Chrome or going to go to Foxfire or Safari, and you then have to figure out whether you're going to the library or whether you're going to live. And I'm sure that must be a little confusing for people, whether it's Heartland Pathways or a number of nonprofits. We have to do battle, and not all of us are sophisticated in these sorts of things. I think that's enough for now. But let me go back to the place where Kay lived, and where I lived also. And we have historic pictures that we could put in here, but those sorts of pictures have to be scanned, and they're not always findable. So one of our big deals is to have pictures that can be retrieved. And David is good at this, and he helps me to figure out how to access prairies or history and that sort of thing. We need people that can do this sort of thing. We need people who are computer literate and can teach others. We still use the language of talking to each other. At about 11 o'clock the other night, Friday night, I think it was, I was seeing somebody go into the little pocket prairie, and I followed them and explained what it was, and they were from Hawaii. One was from Hawaii, and the other cousin was from here. And yes, and they were from some places like Sidoras or Bement. And so if you get to know your territory, you can talk to people like that, and you don't have to be involved with a computer at all. It's a sense of how you explain it and what your excitement is and where you get your jollies because of something hairy that will stop the plant from losing water. Or silly little things that are information, but they help people understand what a prairie is, and very few people understand that. So I'm wanting to take you to the Big Dig because it's only a quarter of a mile away from Weft. It's between downtown and Campustown, which is what they would like to call Middletown. So last night I went over there because I know that it's been planted to big plots of prairie. And we really would like for you to know out there some of your prairie plants, and they're there. A prairie can look like a prairie whether it's got six grasses or if it's got 12 six grasses and six broadleaf plants, or you can have six grasses and perhaps 25 broadleaf plants or 35. Once you're getting a good 10,000 acre prairie would probably have in this area about 110 species. So you're only going to get a few of them if you're going to have a landscaped thing. So yes, the gray-headed coneflower is out, and gray-headed coneflower is a diplomat. It grows very well in slightly disturbed soils, and it peaks in about 4 years from being planted, and then kind of wimps out a little bit as other species take over. So being aware of our photographic challenges, I took a cell phone and I photographed the individuals. It's a little harder to put in something like a video clip, but we do that. And so I have gone through a number of different plants. The yellow coneflower it's also called gray-headed coneflower because when it peaks in its maturity, it looks like the bald-headed gentleman. It's a gray-headed coneflower, and its petals fall down, and that's sort of what makes it a coneflower. They're also purple coneflowers, and purple coneflowers are also a little on the wimpy side. These are plants that are native, and you see plants that are annuals, and these are perennials. They survive, and they're often got small flowers, and they're a little on the wimpy side. So people who are horticulturists take those plants, and they look for sports or they're plants that do something different. They might come up for coneflower with heavier petals that don't sort of look wimpy in the wind. Their color is brighter, and their stature of the plant is more shrub-like, and they flower for longer. So this is appreciated by gardeners. So that's what you learn about if you go to do the master gardening in Consumer Affairs, Agriculture and Consumer Affairs within the university. But then some of those people realize that they don't know very much about the native plants. So there's now a master naturalist program that deals with these plants and how you grow them. So there is the yellow coneflower, the purple coneflower, and there's stiff-leaf goldenrod, and we'll leave time enough to discuss it. It has a sort of grayish leaf. There's asters that are not showing at the moment, but we'll show later. There's big blue stem that is flowering at the moment, and we have people who have a band called Blue Stem. Mm-hmm. And I was at the Friday night event around the corner where there's quite a lot of people listening, and I was talking to someone who actually plays with Blue Stem every once in a while. And they're thinking of going to Australia for a month. And so these sort of interactions are wonderful. So we have areas where the Boneyard comes down through what used to be Second Street, and it I'm not sure whether it's been stocked with fish or creatures, but there's a lot of geese there, which is not very nice for people who don't like their guano. It's a mess everywhere, so but they have ways of discouraging geese. They sort of find their eggs and dismember the eggs. But they're there, and they're enjoying, and every once in a while there's a duck or another creature there, too. There are waterfalls. So there's, the water is pumped up and aerated by a pump, which probably costs a fair bit to run, but it's rather interesting. And you, people love water, and every time you see the water whiten, you have to know that there's a netter there. There's a little creature sitting there taking the bacteria and the fungi that are coming through the water. And there are people climbing on the rocks, and there are people walking hand in hand along the trails. And I sort of have to compliment the city for doing something that retains the water so it doesn't flood Green Street and the shopping area. So the trails can actually be covered with water in a 5-inch rainfall. But then, so this is a detention pond that has been morphed into a natural area, and there are huge buildings all around, and those buildings will probably have high rentals because they have something to look out on. There are basketball courts next nearby. There's a Scott Park that where the water eventually rolls into underground tunnels that where there are probably, I think, 2 8-foot-high drains that take the water down through Campus Town so you don't see it. And then it opens up in the Campus Town area and becomes engineering and other places. Then we're hoping that that openness will continue through to Urbana and become a parkland that's continuous. I'm trying to think of some of the plants. There's some chicory, which is not a prairie plant. It's something that was brought here to be a little bit bitter to provide a bitter taste in coffee. That was enjoyed especially by people in the south who have got used to it. It's a filler to some extent, so you extend the use of your coffee. But it is in the prairie, and it flowers in the morning. Another one that flowers in the morning is spiderwort, and it's there. I didn't see too much dock or compass plant, but the biodiversity is fairly good. And in Scott Park, which is named after a mayor, Scott, Scott Park has a lot of planting, and two people, and I don't remember their name, have had a lot to do with planting there. As you go into the entrance, there's Culver's Root, and there's Black-Eyed Susan. Black-Eyed Susan is a sort of a riot. It grows very well. Most prairie plants are perennial, so you have to wait 5 years to see what's going on. Black-Eyed Susan, I'm not sure whether it's a perennial. It sort of can be a perennial to some extent or a biennial, but it grows quickly within the year. So the Black-Eyed Susan is growing quite well. You get a view of things, and you have to walk across the road and be careful. And the combined area of the Big Dig from down Second Street and across to Scott Park is very nice. I would like to see a toilet there somewhere because some of us get older would like to use it, but toilets are always a controversial thing because the toilet paper always gets stolen and it gets to be a mess. So there's a tendency to to not provide toilet facilities in parks, but as we have an older population, you need to go to the toilet more often, then it's nice to have that sort of facility. How you do it, I don't know. There's been a sewage pumping station put in adjacent to Scott Park, and that's a little different. You have to wonder about how you decide this, where you're going to put a facility like that. So I walk slowly. Sometimes I walk fast, and it's just for exercise, but I enjoy the little waterfalls. And last night I see two geese, I think they were, and they were playing with a fountain that is an aeration fountain, and they were enjoying the different currents that were coming out of that. And it's kind of interesting to see native animals enjoying life and sometimes being more sophisticated than the parent, the human animal that sometimes shuts them off. I'm worried at the moment because there's an announcement in Australia that the removal of rainforest is so devastating to the koala bears that they're being chased by cattle. When you take down the rainforest, you convert the land into cattle, and the cattle are not happy with koala bears, and koala bears are so slow in movement that they can't protect themselves, and when their trees are gone, what do you do? So we have to be thinking about our environment and what we do, and it's not just natural history which we like to look at. On Walnut Street, next across from Weft, there is has been a university gallery, which I thought was helpful in that if you have nine-story buildings and lots of people, they need nooks and crannies where they can go. And sometimes you need nooks and crannies that have tables and chairs that move. It's amazing. The research shows that people who want to sit down often need to move their table 6 inches or their chair 2 inches. It's sort of more acceptable than to have a firm base concrete stools or things tied down, and often you have to tie them down with a screw and a ratchet because it's likely to walk off, or it's likely to become like the Little Pocket Prairie has this problem of sometimes people congregating there and loitering there so that you can't really use it easily as an educational device, and sometimes people sleep there and sometimes people die there. And so how do you have little parks and galleries and resources like having a historic train come into Champaign? How do you do that without the other problem of it being an untoward place? I'm still watching the dumpsters. I was standing in the Market Street the other day, and the dumpster down the street was full of cardboard that was loose. It wasn't compacted. It wasn't broken down. And so help me, there was a volcano of boxes that just blew around the street. And that can easily be solved if people who put cardboard into a cardboard container would please just break the cardboard down. In some cases, people will come with a box full of nicely broken down cardboard, but they put the whole box and dice in the dumpster and take up untoward room that other people could use. And that means that the dumpster gets full and overflowing and it blows around the town, and it's not nice. Mm. So a little bit of thought and a little bit of education is often very, very helpful. So I'm winging it a little bit because I was... so let's... Let's look at the how do you visualize this particular program? How do you how do you put visuals in it without it destroying the imagination of radio? The wonder of radio is that you can tell a story and you interpret it, and you can cry at a certain point, and you can get excited at a certain point. And you don't really need the visuals. The visuals are too practical. But if we're talking about prairie and there's no prairie left and nobody knows what their local ecosystem was, you really need a picture. And then the picture has to go in at a certain level. It can't just be like a pimple on a pumpkin. It has to be part of an integration. So how do we put pictures into this program without destroying that wonderful imagination of a radio program? And it takes time. So do you go out and you take video? Because video is very nice. It can pan across and it can put this plant in a position, and you can zoom in and look at this fruit or its flower. But to coordinate that with monks talk about it is very time consuming. So then stills are better. A single lens reflex is better. If you're in public, you might need a little camera, not a single lens reflex that goes clinkety clunk when you take it and everyone looks around to see who's taken the photograph. And is this a violation of my dignity to be photographed without permission? So there's all sorts of things you can do here, and we're still doing that and wondering how we can encourage others. I was very interested to find that David's been working with the Grateful Dead and Christy Bryan.
Kristen Johns, do you mean?
Kristen Johns has been organizing Grateful Dead, and then suddenly a whole bunch of people come out of the woodwork to be trained to do radio and share the responsibility of this program. We can do with artists that creep around. They might be artists that are cartoonish, that they can take a plant and. Or an animal, and they can make it into a big nose or a big ears, or they can emphasize things that just point to the detail. They can put a line to a point which you don't see otherwise because it's too small, but it directs your attention. Actress Sandra Alton has done a art rendition of the little pocket prairie, which has been very helpful. We take it to meetings and show people what we do. So trained artists can be very helpful. And these days, those trained artists can be cartoonists on computers. So you can, with a long shot, a medium shot, and a close-up, you can say something much better than you could try and put it together with words. And so we do that sometimes. You don't get crazy with taking too many zoom shots or too many pans. You do still, but the wind is blowing and you see the plant moving. So the video mixed in with the still pictures can be wonderful. And we keep learning how to do it, and David has been teaching me how to do that, and I find that tremendously helpful. I come to a point where, wow, I can't listen to that program. And so Jason has just come, and their website, if you say, listen now, it doesn't really go to listen now. So we have to adjust our expertise to know how to use a computer and to use it not excessively, but well. I got a phone call on Walnut Street on Friday night, and there I was walking up the street, and there was a pickup truck almost in front of me. So there's a safety thing involved in this. I had a friend, an Australian, who was stopped at a stoplight, and somebody with a cell phone rear-ended her car, totaled the car, put her in hospital. She walks with canes anymore. But so we have to be careful how we use, abuse, and have a wonder about an era of electronics. Sometimes we have to be worried about the people who do that, and we have some people who have a tremendous ability to do that, but that don't have abilities in other senses. So you have to be able to understand each other and how you get together. Sometimes I'm asked where I come from, because there are people who are going to Australia and they wonder where I lived and grew up. So I sometimes have to explain a little village without electricity, a little village with roadsides that are gravel only and narrow. I have to grow up with cows and chickens and pigs and one teacher schools and picnic grounds, and these are in very, very small communities where if the river floods, you have to put people up on this side of the river so that they become your friends for life, because they're there for perhaps several days and then the river goes down. These days you build a bridge which goes over the river. You don't have a bridge or a ford where you dependent on the creek being small, you can get across it. You just have a high-rise bridge, and you get that sort of development. We were near to a mountain, and that mountain was sharp curves and serious waterfalls and climbs. In 7 miles, it climbed 2,000 feet. And you have to know that in an era when you only have people with picks and shovels to make a road, that you had to go out around things. These days, you put tunnels through hills. You have fences to stop people running off the road and down a 1,000-foot drop. You have places where people can stop if their cars are boiling because the climb is too great and you're in low gear. You have to know that loaded vehicles have the inside channel, even if that's the wrong side of the road. They have weight and they need to be next to the mountain. You have to know that in some cases there's rock and rubble, that if you have a rain, then you're going to have a slip slide. And so on the radio just this week, we have huge slides that where pieces of mountain move whole villages out of whack, because the mountain material might be sitting on a slippery rock like slate or shale. And when you put water on it, and if you put too much water on, the overburden above will slip and take a village out. You have dams sometimes that will burst and cause flooding. But with modern technology, we're solving some of those things if we can do it sensibly. If you're wanting to put dams in, you have to think about the fish and the creatures that are not used to still water and dams. They are used to running water. And so in Danville, we're thinking that there's two dams over there that could be taken back to normal flow of the river. On the other hand, some of the infrastructures that we use, highways and the like, are very helpful. But they do break down, and we have Eisenhower-era infrastructure that now is needing bridge repairs and tarmac repairs. That balance means you have to have a willing crowd of people who are willing to be on city councils and state boards and work at trying to improve what we can. We're not perfect, and the structures we build are not perfect, and we can help, but it's a matter of people being generous enough to be willing to help and do those things. If we don't, we end up with some people doing things and other people not having any resources at all, and that leads us to countries that have a lot of challenges because the wee folk, little folk, don't have any resources, and other people have lots of resources. So how do you balance that in when it's been traditional from the year one that some people will lead and some people will follow? And how do we balance that out so that you have some fair equity amongst the population of people that you have? We also have to look at populations of people. If we keep producing people, then we keep using resources that are beyond our capacity to serve our earthly resources. They're a limited resource, and how can we overpopulate those resources and ruin them? So if you're out there and you're thinking about being environmentalists, think about this weekend and think about what you might do. Yesterday and today, the beautiful days, enjoy them, and just watch what's on your side, and little things count. And this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and nobody else. It is 25 going on 30 seconds before noon here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and that means it's time for the Prairie Monk to be over and time for us to move on to Shruti, Music of India. As always, you're listening to Joel Mabus from his album Flat Pick and Clawhammer. I've picked a different song this time from the usual one that you hear, which is why you may not recognize it. This is another combination of two songs, Over the Waterfall and Mississippi Sawyer. You're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. We are community radio for East Central Illinois.